Hello, in this audio word, we'd like to continue meditating on the spiritual anatomy of the flesh. And we've been looking at all the appearances of the word sarx, that's the word for flesh in Greek. And we've been looking for those the appearances of that word throughout the Greek text of Scripture. And in the previous recording, we had left off in... I believe 1 Peter chapter 4, which has three appearances of sarx in verse 1, in verse 2, and in verse 6. So we were reading all six verses just to get the full context. And we had kind of left off literally in the middle of that of those six verses. We were in verse 3, 1 Peter 4, 3. So we're going to finish our thoughts on that verse and then continue all the way down to verse 6. And then, Lord willing, we'll move on to the appearances of sarx in the next in the next book of Scripture. And that would be 2 Peter. So... we'll just read the first three verses again to get context once again. Verse 1 says, "For as much then as Christ hath suffered for us in the flesh, in the sarx, arm yourselves likewise with the same mind, for he that hath suffered in the flesh hath ceased from sin," or hath, as we saw in the Greek, has put sin on pause. And it's just like a almost like a spiritual technique that God is saying that you just have to tell yourself, "Oh, I'm willing to suffer in the flesh." Just that alone has the power, has power to put sin on pause. Just saying that I'm going to have a predisposition to suffer in the flesh, as the Lord. As is required, so that the will of God will be fulfilled. And again, it doesn't mean that you have to go out, go look for a hammer and hit yourself, hit your hand with the hammer on purpose just to suffer. It's not masochism, but it's saying, well, if it's needed, I open myself up to that. And then verse 2 says that 1 Peter 4, 2, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh to the lusts of men, but to the will of God. We saw that this verse was basically mistranslated. It says in the original Greek, the word live that is mentioned here is bioo. The verb from where we get words like biology or biography in English, and it has this strong connotation of life, but more biological life than spiritual life. And so it says that he no longer should have biological life, the rest of his time, his chronos time, which again speaks of chronological time, the time that you see ticking on a clock, not spiritual time but literal time, in the flesh. So it's like putting us in the midst of the natural realm and being aware that time is a ticking, and that we have a biological life to live out in the flesh, and that has a purpose, and it's to manifest the glory of God on earth and to carry out His will, so that His kingdom will be established. So then it says that we should no longer live the rest of our time, our chronos time, in the sarx, in the flesh, to the lusts of men. And the word lust was translated from epithumia. But to the will of God. And so actually, now that I look at it, this verse was not really that badly translated. It more or less is what it says. I guess I was thinking about the next verse. So verse 3 says, For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles. And the word will there was translated from telema, which does mean will in Greek. So the will of the Gentiles, and the mistranslation is in the word Gentiles, when we shared on that in the previous recording. So we'll just say it very quickly here that this should have been translated will of the nations, because Peter is including himself in this, and he was a more or less faithful follower of Jewish customs and laws. So it's not, he's not talking about Gentiles in the sense of non-Jews. He's talking about nations, because that's what the word is in Greek, ethnos. And ethnos means nation, literally, but it's usually translated as Gentile, because the Jewish people would refer to the non-Jews as the nations, the goyim. That's what goyim literally means in Hebrew. So it's saying, so this verse is talking about the will of the nation. So that means that we have to have this awareness of what nations are trying to influence our will. Nations have a will. And as you're in the midst of a nation or surrounded by a nation, you can be influenced by it. So it helps to recognize, oh, I'm being influenced by this force of this will of a certain nation. And the nation could be your family, could be the church. With matriarchals, it's usually the local church they attend. That nation influences, but it's a nation that is not necessarily guided by God, and the nation could also be the literal nation, your literal country, or it could be the racial group you belong to, your ethnicity, your friends in school, whatever. They create a will. So it's like this awareness that there are nations out there, and those nations have a will. Each of them has a will, and that will try to influence our will. And it's easier sometimes to break something, overcome something, when you know where it's coming from. Because if you think it's coming from inside of you, it might be a little more difficult to fight. And it's when you realize, oh no, this is coming from the outside. And I say, okay, I reject that. Then it's easier to have victory. So then we began to look at the list of things that are mentioned here. When we walked in lasciviousness, lusts, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries. And this list is in verse 3 of 1 Peter 4. So we began to look at the first three. Lasciviousness was translated from the word aselgeia, which, as we shared before, is better translated as incontinence. It's when someone is just out of control. Someone who cannot contain him or herself. And aselgeia, which I believe we mentioned that there's a posting on the Shamayilim website where we talk about aselgeia. And to be frank, I don't remember exactly which one it was. Let me just look it up very quickly. I believe it's Romans 13, part 8, if I am not mistaken, where we go into detail about what aselgeia means spiritually. And we saw that it's a combination of Hittite prophet and Girgashite teacher. And prophet and teacher usually are kind of like opposites in a sense. So it's kind of this strange double combination of two things that contradict each other. The prophetic and the teacherly, but both misguided. And we saw that if you had to summarize it, might not be an oversimplification, but a way to summarize it could be that it's someone who acts prophetically and just lets himself or herself go. Saying what's in their mind because they're flowing prophetically, but who cannot control that prophetic flow the spirit, the prophetic spirit, is not under their dominion. But then also when it comes time to go to act prophetically in order to sacrifice yourself for others, then suddenly they stop being prophetic and they become Girgashite. So they're prophetic as long as it benefits them in some way, or as long as it makes them feel good. But once that prophetic flow implies pouring yourself, flowing in prophetic sacrifice as a libation offering for the sake of others, then suddenly they stop being prophetic and they turn into the opposite, Girgashite. So they are Hittite Girgashite. Hittite is a prophet gone bad. Girgashite is the teacher gone bad, as we share on the website. So Aselgeia, that lasciviousness is a prophet or Hittite Girgashite, shall we say. But I pray that in the previous recording, if you had an opportunity to listen to it, that you saw the substance of it, so that we can recognize it in others and avoid having it manifested in our lives, that we not manifest that type of prophetic incontinence that suddenly becomes very continent, very self-contained when it comes to giving yourself in prophetic sacrifice. Then suddenly the prophetic flow stops. So then the next item on the list that the Lord provided through Peter here in 1 Peter 4:3 is lusts, and that is epithumia. And we saw in the previous recording, if you may recall, that it's very Canaanite. It's this overflow of passions, and the Canaanite spirit, which is the pastor gone bad, is the spirit of low passions. It's just excessive passions, and it's different from the emotional flow of aselgeia. Aselgeia is more of a prophetic emotional flow. Epithumia is an emotional flow, but at a more relationship level or personal level, if that makes sense. It's more related to soul communion and passions for one another, if that makes sense. That sort of kind of personal, interpersonal kind of thing. It's distorted, and then it also has these elements of Hittite deception, and I believe we briefly may have talked about that in the last recording. So in short, this lusts or epithumia that is mentioned here is a combination of someone who is very Canaanite and very Hittite at the same time, who by his passions follows things that are false. It's like a young lady that finds a young guy, very attractive, and then she has this epithumia for the young guy, and then she has a relationship with him, and then as time goes by, she realizes that that he was not that his beauty was just external, and then he turns out, let's say, to be a monster or some horrible person. That's a very clear example of someone who was deceived by their epithumia. And obviously, we just mentioned an example of a woman falling for a guy, but it can also happen, and it happens a great deal the other way around. Men who see a beautiful woman and they have the epithumia, this overflow of passions for this person, and then when they get to know them better, they realize that she's a monster on the inside. So that young man was deceived by his epithumia. So there's it's a combination of Canaanite and Hittite in epithumia. And then the other word that we saw it's translated as excess of wine. In 1 Peter 4:3, and that comes from oinophligia, and we saw that was a combination of Amorite, because it's related to wine, and wine is connected to the evangelistic, and the evangelistic goes bad and turns Amorite. And it's also very Canaanite. It's very strongly connected to bubbles, to just releasing bubbles that are just air, hot air, with nothing really substantive inside. And it's a figure of empty soul communion between people. And just as a side note, after the recording, I was wondering if what I had said was right when thinking about an example for oinophlegia, and what I kept seeing in my mind, and I felt it was of the Lord, was people in at a nightclub partying, and also we mentioned an example of when, for example, at a company, they were trying to win a very important account, and they get the account, and they celebrate, what I said was, and then they take out a bottle of wine to celebrate. But I said within me, people normally don't do that. If they do celebrate, it won't be with wine. It's usually champagne for some reason. So I said, was that a good example? And then before this recording, I felt prompted to within me, like, maybe that what I was prompted to say was a technically correct example, because champagne is wine, isn't it? Champagne comes from grapes, and grapes is where you get wine from. So even though champagne doesn't look like wine, at least to me, then it must be wine. So I did a search, search online, and lo and behold, they said that it is indeed wine. It's a form of sparkling wine, and they mentioned that it has to be wine within 100 miles of the province of Champagne in France or something like that. But at the end of the day, it is wine. And interestingly, champagne, as we all know, has bubbles on the inside. And this oinophlegia thing, the second part of the word, phlegia, comes from another word that means bubbles. So it just seems to confirm that, that celebration and soul communion because you had victory. So in a negative sense, you can see the Amorite, which has to do with unrighteous victories, and Canaanite, which is unrighteous uncontrolled or whatever, soul communion. So oinophlegia is Amorite Canaanite. So once again, aselgeia, lasciviousness, is Hittite Girgashite. Epithumia, which is lust, is Canaanite Hittite. And then oinophlegia is Amorite Canaanite. And then the next thing that is mentioned by the Lord through Peter in 1 Peter 4:3 is revelings. So it's lasciviousness, lusts, excess of wine, revelings. And revelings was translated from komos, K-O-M-O-S, if you Latinize the word from the Greek, if you put it in the Latin alphabet, it would be K-O-M-O-S. And we have shared on that word on the Shamayalam website, in the posting called the article called Romans 13 Part 7. So aselgeia is mentioned in Romans 13 Part 8, and komos is mentioned in Romans 13 Part 7. That's an article that was posted on the 9th of February 2014, so more than 12 years ago from the time of this recording. So we're just going to read some things here very quickly. It says in the article, the word rioting was translated from the Greek word komos. This is in reference to Romans 13:13, where it's translated as rioting. And that's what's so frustrating, all the variations, because it's translated as riotings in Romans 13:13, but it's translated as revelings in 1 Peter 4:3. I mean, you could say, well, maybe the words are similar in English, but rioting and reveling, I don't know. I wish that it would just be one word, and that would make it much easier in English to see that the two verses are connected in some way. So it says here, the word rioting was translated from the Greek word komos, which can be translated as revel or carousal, and was a word used many centuries ago to describe a raucous nocturnal procession of intoxicated men who, after eating and drinking, would parade through the streets with torches and music in honor of Bacchus, the Roman god of agriculture and wine, or some other deity. The drunken partiers would stop in front of the house of male and female friends and sing loudly, inviting their friends to join the raucousness. Notice, therefore, that despite their chaos, these wild Como's parades had a strong procedural nature to them, and they had a strong taste of tradition. Hence, the word Como's points to the teacher endowment, which, as we've shared before, is strongly procedural and tradition-oriented in its nature. Since the tradition of Como's parades was clearly a man-made tradition backed by a false theological system, we can safely conclude that it was upheld and perpetuated by a distorted manifestation of the teacher endowment. Because there was this man-made tradition, and the teacher endowment kept passing it from generation to generation. That's what is meant there. Then it says, thus, Como's points to the Girgashite spirit, since, as we've shared before, the Girgashite spirit is, in essence, the teacher endowment gone bad. And then it says, notice also that Como's parades had a strong proselytizing element to them, since the revelers would take to the streets in an effort to infect strangers with their celebration spirit, and they would target the houses of male and female friends to get them to join in their celebration. As we've shared before, the heart is where the will resides, and the ministry most directly related to influencing the heart and rallying wills is the evangelistic ministry. Hence, we can say that Como's parades were very evangelistic in their nature. It's evident that these parades were more evangelistic than teacher-centric at heart, since evangelists are more naturally inclined to celebrating than teachers are. Teachers in and of themselves can be very dry and at times very joyless. Therefore, we can conclude that these Como's parades were carried out by evangelists under the influence of a distorted teacher, i.e. Girgashite endowment. So in short, Como's is this combination of evangelistic, winning people over to join in the celebration, and then very Girgashite because it's very tradition oriented. And we share on this in this article that spiritually speaking, like when an evangelist rides the coattails of traditions in order to be more successful, then he or she, without realizing it, is committing rioting or reveling. The reveling that's being mentioned in 1 Peter 4:3, even though they're not partying, they're not doing Mardi Gras stuff or getting drunk or anything like that, but in God's eyes, they're doing Como's. It's exactly the same thing. When you ride on the coattails of traditions, of human, earthly, Girgashite traditions, in order to be more popular and win more people over, even if it's to win them over, quote, to the gospel, then in God's eyes, you're committing Como's. And Billy Graham used to do a lot of that. He used to ride on the coattails of the traditions and the structures of the religious structures of man that were anti-spirit. And he would use that to fill stadiums and get more people to repeat the prayer of salvation and all that. And you'd say, well, that was a good thing. Yeah, but the problem is that, and I'll say this very bluntly, if someone is meant to be saved, God will reach them somehow. Now, the thing is, if you get to them the wrong way and they're born prematurely because you bypass the process and try to get them to just repeat the prayer, that's all you cared about, them repeating the prayer, yeah, they might get saved faster, quote unquote, but because you took them out of the oven before you could stick a fork in them, before they were done, then that person, because he was a spiritual primie, then that person has a less chance of fulfilling their spiritual calling, and they might die before they, spiritually speaking, before they get to to fulfill what God had for them. It's like if someone had reached Paul before it was time, somehow, he might have converted, but he would not have had the zeal and the awareness of what God wanted for him. It's like the other example that I always think of is the guy who's the crippled person who sat by the gate, the beautiful, the one that Peter and John healed. That's described in the first few books of Acts. I think it was Acts chapter 4, somewhere around there, or 3. It's described that Peter and John saw the man there, and he had been there for 40 years, if I'm not mistaken, or he was 40 years old or something like that. But the thing is, he had hung around that gate for a long, long time. And if you think about it, because we don't catch that as we're reading it, but if you sit back and think about it, you go, well, that fellow was there for 40 years, let's say. Or I forget, 40 plus years is mentioned somewhere. I don't remember if that's how old he was or if that's how many years he had been sitting by the gate. But I do remember that he was there for a long, long time. He was well known. Everybody knew him. That's what made the miracle so amazing. Because it was not like some hired actor that Peter and John paid to pretend to be a cripple and to, you know, to just jump up and say, hallelujah, I'm healed. It was a guy that everybody knew that he had been a cripple for a long, long time. So if you think about it, this happened shortly after Yeshua ascended. So this means that brother, now brother, that crippled man, had been there by the gate, the beautiful, the whole time Yeshua was ministering on earth. The whole time. And every time the Lord went to Jerusalem, that guy was there. And Yeshua never took the time to heal that guy. Think about that. He never took the time to heal that guy. And he must have walked past him several times. Who knows? And God had his eye on that guy. God the Father had his eyes on that guy. Yet Yeshua, the Son of God, who did God's perfect will, never, never bothered to go preach to him. Why? Because it was not the time. That crippled person had things to go through in his life so that that needed to be completed so that by the time he received the Lord, he would have a conversion that would be transformative. And on top of that, that crippled man had a purpose. In the healing of that man, thousands would be saved. He would become a source. That crippled man, after all those years of suffering, would, through his healing, become a source of salvation for thousands of people. So in other words, that healing made the years of suffering and sorrow and emptiness made that worthwhile, because thousands of, literally thousands, I forget if it was 5 or 3,000 but or 4,000, but it was in that range of people that got saved when they saw what God did for that man. So if Yeshua had healed him before the time, then the purpose for that man would have been cut short. The purpose of all that suffering he went through would have been cut short. And the power of life that would have flowed into him would have been less. That's why Yeshua left him there crippled. And he, because he knew that Peter and John would then come later to heal that man. So the thing is, If Billy Graham had done things the right way, he would have had a lot of trouble with a lot of crusades, because a lot of churches would have said, we're not going to help you. Because Billy Graham started as a more or less Pentecostal evangelist. If you listen to some of his sermons, like recordings of when he was young, he was much more effusive. He sounded like a Pentecostal preacher. And if I'm not mistaken, he might have been literally baptized by had the baptism of the Holy Ghost. But he he realized, oh, I just need to kind of do the more like find the I think it's least common denominator in mathematics kind of a thing. Like, let me strip myself of as much as possible so that I can be acceptable to the largest number of denominations and congregations, because I need their help for the logistics and to help me with getting their congregations to attend the crusade, so that the people in the congregation can bring friends, unsaved friends, and I need their help, the help of these churches to provide manpower for the event, and maybe help with the finances to rent a place, and this and that and the other. And he said, I need all of this, and I need to run on I need to ride the coattails of the structures and procedures that man has created. So he didn't care if these churches denied the power of the Holy Spirit. He didn't care if these churches denied the gift of prophecy or anything like that. He said, I just need to work with them. So yeah, he saved lots of people, but a great deal of these people were saved before their time. And because they were saved before their time, the power of their life as a believer was cut short. And that's why if he had said, no, I will trust God, I will do it his way. And I know that if I do it his way, the power, even if I have to wait a little longer, the power, the impact of what I will do in him will be so much greater and so much will have an eternal impact that I cannot possibly have happen if I get ahead of God. If I try to do it through earthly means. So Billy Graham, when he stood before the Lord, I'm sure he got a big surprise that God said, you're a rioter, you're a reveler. And he must have wondered, what are you saying, Lord? Why are you saying that? I wasn't a drinker. I wasn't a carouser. Well, yes, you were, because you turned into, you to me were like these people in ancient times who, in honor of Bacchus, would go from house to house inviting people to join the celebration, because that's exactly what your people, the people that you used, were doing when they were going from place to place trying to get people to go to the Crusades. Same thing in my eyes, and that's what so this is what Billy Graham and people like him were doing. They were doing Comos. Okay, so it's a combination of evangelistic and Girgashite, trying to ride the coattails of Girgashite traditions and customs and methodologies to conquer things. So it's distorted evangelist and distorted teacher. So it's Amorite, Girgashite. So now we have four. And then the next one is rather peculiar. So we'll say something about that, I believe, and then come back. I think that's the way we should do it. And then we'll review the six, the list of six, and try to see if there's a pattern there. And I'm getting a sense in my heart that there is a pattern, and I pray in the Lord that this is not coming from me, that this is hit, that it's I pray that this is exactly what the Lord is intending to say in this verse. I was asking the Lord about it, and I got the sense that this is correct. So we'll say it, and I pray that if it's not of the Lord, that God will cover your mind and not let you receive it, and that you will, and that he will give you exactly what it is, if it's not what we're about to say. So the next thing on the list of 1 Peter 4:3 is banquetings, and to me, that's about as bad a translation as it can get. I don't know. I when I saw the word in Greek, I said, banquetings. So banquetings was translated or mistranslated from the word potos. And potos is kind of an interesting word because it's the word from where you get a river. Like potamos, I think was the word that we mentioned at some point in another recording, if I'm not mistaken. And it literally comes from the word, the verb pino in Greek that means to drink. So potos, it's like, for example, when people talk about potable water, P-O-T-A-B-L-E, I believe that means water that you can drink, potable. And this is, that potable word in English comes from potos in Greek. So potos literally means drinkings. When people get together to drink, you know, that's potos. So that's why banqueting doesn't sound right. Maybe it's an old English thing, that maybe banquetings meant something else in the old days, in the days of the King James translators, but banqueting makes me think of a banquet where people sit down and you know, there's a big big turkey or a big, you know, chicken, and people grab the leg of the chicken and start eating it, kind of like in medieval times. That's what I think of banqueting. But the word in Greek does not have the connotation of eating. It's literally drinkings. It is it's about drinking. So the question is, what does that mean? What is that related to? And what I get in my heart, and this is where I could be wrong, is that this word is connected very strongly to the Canaanite spirit. And this might be a very simplistic way of seeing it, but when people are, the Canaanite spirit is the spirit of low passions, and it's the spirit behind addictions. And obviously one of the, unfortunately, most common addictions is drinking too much. And if someone is just drinking, that is usually connected to that horrible spirit of alcoholism, of the Canaanite spirit of alcoholism. So that's why just the connotation of drinking just makes me think Canaanite. And it feels like, how shall we say it? When people fall into that horrible, trap of alcoholism, they go to the bar to drink. They go to the pub and they just start drinking, and the drinking becomes like an obligation, if that makes sense, because the body starts demanding it. They can't stop drinking, unless the power of God comes, they keep drinking, and they drink because they enjoy it to some extent. But then it's more than just enjoying it. They just have to do it. Even if they're not enjoying it anymore, they need to do it again and again. So there's a law that starts going into effect, if that makes sense. And something forcing you to do something, even if you actually don't feel like it, but you just have to do it. And that compulsion is connected to the Jebusite spirit. The Jebusite spirit is the spirit of legalism, the one that tells you, you must do this, you must do that, you must do the other. And it does judgments on you, but from the flesh, not from the spirit. It's the apostle gone bad, as we've said so many times. The apostle is a judging, is the ministry of wisdom and judgments. And the Jebusite is human wisdom, and applying that human wisdom in legalistic judgments, and it's the spirit of pressure and oppression. Like, it forces you, you must do this, you must do that, you must do the other. It's a horrible spirit to live under. So you can see, I pray that like if we're talking about drinking and it's just someone who just goes to a place to drink, they don't go there to eat because they're really not interested in eating. They're just there to drink because they need to feed the addiction. Then you can see that it's very Canaanite because it's an addiction, a low passion. And at the same time, it's Jebusite because it's done under the spirit of compulsion. So you could say in short that Potos is Canaanite, Jebusite. So that's the combination of those two things. And why is God listing these things? It's so that we can kind of get a sense of when we have an issue, a menstrual issue that, as we described, you know, before, that's referring to when there are spots in our flesh, or places in our flesh that do involuntary things. They're like a menstrual issue, if that makes sense. And it's like the Lord is describing the types of menstrual issues that our flesh can have so that we can like recognize it and control it and put it under the control of the Spirit of God. So it's good to recognize it. So sometimes you can have a Canaanite tendency with a Jebusite compulsion. It's like the drinking example, I think is pretty straightforward, but a more subtle example could be like a young lady that needs to, I don't know why I said young lady, it could be a young man, but a young lady that just needs to go out with her friends every Friday night. And yes, at the beginning it was to have fun and to dance or go clubbing or whatever, but then it just becomes a need. That she just has to go clubbing every Friday night, and even though she's not enjoying it that much anymore, she just has this thing that she has to do it because she feels like her life will not be complete if she doesn't do it, even though she feels empty afterwards anyway. So there you can see that there's a Jebusite spirit doing the compulsion, and it's important to recognize it and say, oh, okay, I have this Canaanite thing, but there's a Jebusite spirit hiding behind this that is forcing me to do this, even though sometimes I don't feel like doing it anymore. And it's important once you recognize that, oh, it's easy. That's why I feel the compulsion. There's a Jebusite spirit here, making me do this all the time, this involuntary thing. So that's why the Lord is listing this so that we can kind of discern it. Okay, and then the last thing on the list is in English, it's the word, the phrase abominable idolatries. That's the last thing on the list. And abominable, interestingly enough, was translated from a Greek word, atemitos. And atemitos, it says here, is derived from a. The a part means without, or there's negation. It's the negation prefix, you could say, in Greek. And then the themitos part comes from the word tithemi, which means to establish. It's the negation of the established. Atemitos, literally, the word it says here means contrary to law and justice, prohibited by law, illicit, criminal. It's only used twice in Scripture, in 1 Peter 4:3, the verse we're reading, and in Acts 10:28, it says, "And he said unto them," this is Peter speaking, I believe, "and he said unto them, ye know how that it is an unlawful thing, atemitos." So it's translated unlawful thing. How it is an unlawful thing, an atemitos, for a man that is a Jew to keep company or come unto one of another nation. But God hath shewed me that I should not call any man common or unclean." So it's Peter talking about, y'all know, because all y'all are fellow Jews like me, all y'all know that we're not supposed to, it's unlawful, atemitos, for us to have company with those from another nation, from, you know, the Gentiles. But God has declared, God told me not to call any man common or unclean. So as you can see, atemitos has this connotation of law, but it's the opposite. And you could say, well, then if it's the opposite of law, then it's chaos. But no, this is different. Because there's another word, like without law, anomos. That's where we get anomaly in English. A means without or negation, and nomos means law in Greek, if I'm not mistaken. So anomos means without law, lawless. But this is not talking about lawlessness, like in the sense of, no restraints and we're going to do whatever we want. That's not the type of law, of lack of law, that this is talking about. This is, it's like someone who establishes the opposite of what the law says. It's like saying, well, the law says I can't smoke here. Well, I'm going to smoke here. So I'm going to make it my personal law that every time I come here, I'm going to smoke because the law says that I can't smoke. It's established. It's almost like, it's not saying, oh, I'm not going to follow any law. I'm just going to go by chaos, Hittite chaos. That's not it. Or I'm going to go by Canaanite passions and reject the law or of God or something. It's not that. It's rejecting the law, but it's rejecting the law by doing like the opposite, like establishing a counter law or an anti-law, saying I'm going to do the opposite of what God says, and I'm going to do it as a law, and I'm going to force myself to do the opposite just because. Okay, and by the way, I felt at times to do things like that, but not towards the law of God, but towards the law of man. When the law of man says don't do that, that's when I sometimes felt compelled to do exactly the opposite of what man is saying I should not do, when I know it's against God's will. If that makes sense. If I am in an environment that is imposing a law on me that is not of God, that is the opposite of, it is contrary to God, that is defying God, it's the law of man. A law of a place, let's say, but it's defying God, then I go out of my way many times to defile that law, to oppose that law, to say to that law, I don't care, I'm going to do exactly the opposite of what you're telling me to do, in defiance. So there are times that you are to do that, but it's, you know, obviously when it's a law that's contrary to God, and sometimes God will say don't do anything, and sometimes God will say go and defy that law, go out of your way to defy that law. You know, it's for example, like if you're talking to someone who's a racist, let's say back in the 60s, a person who was against black people, a racist, then I, in that context, I would like go out of my way to say talk about all the great black athletes, all the great black artists, and all the great things that the black culture has contributed to America. That's what I would do, to rub it in that person's face, and to make him as angry and as uncomfortable as possible. So there are times that you are supposed to do that, but it's obviously when it's a law that's not of God. But the thing is that that's the connotation I get, or the sense I get by this word atemitos, that they unfortunately translated abominable. It's not abominable. There's another word for abominable. I forget when it talks, for example, when scripture talks about the abomination of desolation. It's a different word as far as I recall. Sorry, let me just confirm that. just to be sure I'm not saying something that's not true. Abomination of desolation. So I'm going to do a search right now of that phrase to see in the Greek how God says abomination. Let's see. So I'm reading. I just found Matthew 24:15 that mentions abomination of desolation, and the word abomination there is a very strange word, a very unusual word in Greek. It's bedeligma. It's the B and D together, which is very odd to have those two consonants together, beta and delta, the B and the D. Bedeligma. As you can see, nothing to do with Artemitos. So that's what's so frustrating about these translations. Abominable is just a completely different thing. It just makes you think of something completely different. So they, in the worst of cases, they should have said unlawful, just as they did in the other verse that we just read, Acts 10, that uses Artemitos. Why do they change it to abominable here? So it's really unlawful, but it's something like anti-law. That's kind of how I get it in my heart. It's someone who goes out of his way to defy the law of God by establishing a counter-law. And then the other word, idolatries, that was correctly translated from the almost identical Greek word, idolatria. And eidolo obviously means idol, and the latria part means like priesthood. It's like liturgy or things that a priest does. So it's like idolatry is when you establish a priesthood in honor of a false god. That's kind of spiritually speaking what idolatry is. Idolatry is when you establish a system of priesthood to honor something that is not God. Like what a lot of people do with AI nowadays, they're creating an idolatry towards AI, and they create like this priesthood that is to serve AI and honor AI. You can't say anything bad about AI, because if you do, then you're of the devil and you're blaspheming against our idol. In a lot of companies they set up these rules that thou shalt not speak ill of AI, and thou shalt not criticize AI, thou shalt not say AI has lied to me, etc., etc. You might think I'm exaggerating, but I know exactly what I'm saying. I'm not speculating that this is how it might be. This is I know that there are many companies where they do exactly what I just said, where it is prohibited for people to say AI lied to me, that AI gave me false information. So it's idol. It's a priesthood that is created around a false idol. Idolatry is when you have to put a statue in front of you in order to have faith. You have to see it to believe in it and follow it. And that again points to the Girgashite spirit, because that's the spirit that focuses on the visible. You need to see something to believe it, to believe in it. And also it's the Girgashite spirit is the spirit of methodologies. That is very good at establishing protocols and things like that, things that you need for a good priesthood. You need to do this ritual, you need to do this, and this. That's all very teacherly, but obviously this is it's being done for something evil, so it's Girgashite, the teacher gone bad. So you can see two things there. In the word Artemitos, you see the Jebusite thing going on, because it's like you're going to do the opposite of the law of God. You establish a counter law to deny the law of God, and that's when so that's the Jebusite spirit coming in with laws of men, because the Jebusite spirit is the apostle gone bad, It's the judge who judges incorrectly, and judgments are from where you get laws. I mean, laws and judgments are interconnected. You can't have judgments without law, and laws are useless without judgments. So it's very Jebusite and Girgashite. So the last element that is mentioned, which was abominable, but let's say more correctly, unlawful idolatries, atemitos idololatria, that is a combination of Jebusite and Girgashite. So to summarize, there are six things that God has pointed out, wants us to think about here. So it is lasciviousness, aselgeia, which is Hittite Girgashite. And then epithumia, which was lusts, is Canaanite Hittite. So if you notice, the first two are Hittite. Aselgeia is Hittite with Girgashite. Is the prophet who is very prophetic until it's time to die. Then he becomes a Girgashite. Epithumia is the Canaanite passions that lead people to deceptions. You know, like the young lady that fell in love with this handsome young man that turned out to be a gangster or criminal or something, but she got so caught up in the emotion and the epithumia of the relationship, the soul communion, that she didn't see that the guy was a gangster or a murderer or something like that. So that's just an exaggeration, an example just to illustrate the idea of how the Canaanite can lead you into Hittite deception. The Hittite spirit is the spirit of deceptions, of falsehoods and lies and things like that. So the first two are Hittite. One is Hittite Girgashite, the other one is Hittite Canaanite. And Girgashite is teacher gone bad. Canaanite is a pastor gone bad. Pastor and teacher are the two female ministries. So God in those two, it feels like God in those two words was saying how the Hittite spirit comes in when there's pastoral matriarchy. If that makes sense, the Hittite spirit can come in into a person's life when that person's life is influenced by the pastoral matriarchy. Because the pastoral matriarchy is Girgashite Canaanite, you know, bad teacher, bad pastor. And the Girgashite part of the matriarchy, the Hittite spirit will latch on to the Girgashite part of you, and then you will become lascivious. But lascivious is a bad translation. The word just doesn't do it justice in English. You become aselgeia, or you begin to manifest aselgeia, this incontinence, the Hittite spirit is just making you do stuff and flow, quote, prophetically in things. And you start fighting for causes, for stupid causes, and get involved in this and get involved in that. You do all these crazy things. But then when it comes time to, okay, if you're that prophetic, are you willing to die for someone else? Are you willing to sacrifice yourself for someone else? And suddenly, ooh, can't go for that. No can do. And you go, oh, no, I don't want to die. I want to be a prophet, but I don't want to die. You know, that sort of thing. So the Hittite spirit comes in and lashes on. It's like what happens is when the two female ministries are in control, pastor, teacher, they negate the true apostle, the true prophet, the true evangelist, the three male ministries. When the two female ministries control things, they negate the three male ministries, at least in their righteous manifestation. And because they don't let those three ministries in, you know, in righteousness, then they leave a spiritual vacuum. So because they don't let the prophetic flow in a male spirit-centric way, they leave that vacuum there, and then that vacuum is filled by the prophet gone bad spirit. which is the Hittite spirit. So then inside the church, the Hittite spirit starts coming in. And then it starts hitting people, especially those who are prophetically inclined in that congregation. So the Hittite spirit starts coming in and boom, it latches on to the prophetic calling of the person, and because it's not being nurtured because you're there in the matriarchal environment, then their prophetic calling turns Hittite, and then it latches on to the Girgashite or to the Canaanite. I hope that's making sense. So when it combines with the Girgashite, it becomes Asangeia, a prophet who is incontinent, but suddenly becomes very continent when it comes time to dying for others. And then there will be some who will have their Hittite contamination be combined with the Canaanite spirit, and that leads to epithumias, where they develop lots of passions of soul communion, and they are led down Hittite deceptions. So that's how it's manifesting in the church, and it can manifest in our lives even if we're not going to a matriarchal church, because we have a soul, and if we allow the soul to rule in our hearts and minds inside of us, in some ways, then these will be manifested in us even if we're not going to a matriarchal church, if that makes sense. So that's why we have to learn them and kind of recognize them and be able to deal with them. And then the other two, so Asalgeia, Epithumia is the Hittite spirit combined with the Girgashite and the Canaanite, with bad teacher, bad pastor. And then Oinophlegia, I forget how they translated it. Excess of wine. That Oinophlegia is Amorite Canaanite, as we said. And Amorite Canaanite, why? Because it is having a conquering spirit, but it's a conquering spirit that just focuses on soul communion. You know, it's like those people who are in the nightclub, all these handsome and beautiful men and women who have a lot of evangelistic grace, and they are young, full of evangelistic strength, but they're using all that grace and strength just for meaningless soul communion, these bubbles of soul communion, and it's just conquering in emptiness, in Canaanite emptiness. And that's Oinophlegia. So it's the evangelistic gone bad and contaminated by the Canaanite spirit. And then the next one is Comos, which we saw is Amorite Girgashite. So notice the next two are Amorite. One is Amorite Canaanite, and the other one is Amorite Girgashite. So again, the same pattern. Because the matriarchal church leaves vacuums, it doesn't let in the apostolic, the prophetic, and the evangelistic, at least the right way, then the evangelistic vacuum is filled by the opposite of evangelist, which is the Amorite. So people in that congregation or in that environment that are evangelistic, their evangelism gets contaminated and becomes Amorite, and then the Amorite latches on to Girgashite or Canaanite, depending on the person and the circumstances. So when it latches on to the Canaanite, then people go into excesses of wine, the clubbing. And clubbing is just a figure. It's a literal example, I would say, but it's I hope it's not taken as just a literal thing. It's a figure of something more spiritual. So you start doing spiritual clubbing, shall we say, and going on conquests, to conquer a young lady at the club, at the nightclub, to engage in a Canaanite relationship, to conquer the young lady for a Canaanite relationship, that sort of thing. And when that Amorite stuff gets combined with the Gurkhaside traditions, then it becomes Komos. There's very structured reveling where you go from house to house, and as we were describing, and telling people, come join this Amorite celebration, come. And we saw that, as we said a moment ago, that Komos is the thing that people like Billy Graham and many evangelists like him were doing. And what they do by entering into that sort of thing is to produce a lot of premature babies, spiritual babies that don't live out their potential because they were taken out of the oven too quickly, because the evangelist was unwilling to not compromise. It was just too much for them. It wasn't worth it, and they just wanted the quick result, and they didn't believe in the long-term plans of God. I would rather pray for, if I know it's not the time, I'd rather pray for that person to be saved at the right time and to be protected so that that person can reach that time in their life the best way possible, so that then they will fulfill their calling. So in other words, I'd be praying for protection over the person until the time comes, instead of trying to get the person to convert when it's not the time yet. Well, you say, well, you never know when the person's going to die. Well, yeah, but God does. But God does. And if God is telling you to back off, you back off. If reaching that person implies you compromising on the plan, the purposes of God, and compromising the principles of God, then you don't do it. Oh, but the person's not going to get saved. Well, yes, they will get saved. God will reach them, but it will be at a different time, the right way. I can't take the risk. Well, you're basically saying you don't trust God. You don't trust God's process. And a lot of the Komos people that's exactly what's going on, because they want to go by the visible, the Gurkhaside spirit of the visible. They want the visible, tangible result right now. The Gurkhaside cannot wait too much. They're so tied up in Chronos time, they cannot wait. They cannot take a more prophetic perspective of the eternity, of the long term. The prophet is willing to sow into eternity. The Gurkhaside wants the harvest right now, right now. I need to see it right now. I plant the seed and I want the harvest tomorrow. And then the next two are Potos and Athemitos Idololatria, which was mistranslated as banquetings and abominable idolatries, but it's really more drinkings and unlawful or anti-law idolatry. So we saw that Potos, which is the drinkings, is Canaanite Jebusite, when you get trapped in the Canaanite spirit. And then there's a Jebusite spirit compelling you to continue that in the Canaanite behavior. And then Athemitos Idololatria, we saw that it was Jebusite Gurkhaside. Gurkhaside because you're looking at an idol and you need to see it. You're focused on the visible and you create a priestly system around that. And then Athemitos, we saw it has this connotation of the counter law, establishing a law that opposes the law of God. So Jebusite and Gurkhaside. So the last two, as you can see, are Jebusite. One is Canaanite Jebusite, the other one is Jebusite Gurkhaside. And again, the same thing. The Jebusite gets combined with Canaanite and Gurkhaside. Pastor gone bad, teacher gone bad. So as you can see, the six things are God's way of saying this is how the three male ministries degrade in a place that is ruled by pastors and teachers, by female pastors and female teachers. And female, we mean spiritually, even if there are literal males, spiritually female soulish pastors and soulish teachers. In other words, Canaanites and Girgashites. Because they don't let in the apostolic, the prophetic, and the evangelistic the right way, in the spirit, they let it in part, but it's always, you know, with soul compromises. Then it's really not apostolic. And then it's really not prophetic. Then it's really not evangelistic. So because they don't let in the true apostle, the true prophet, the true evangelist, the three male ministries, then those three male ministries get corrupted in the people in the congregation that are apostolic, prophetic, and evangelistic, because they're not growing in that. Then the apostolic turns Jebusite, the prophetic turns Hittite, the evangelistic turns Amorite, and those three things, the three evil spirits, start combining with the two that control the place, the Canaanite and the Girgashite. So then you have the let's say the apostolic, the Jebusite, combining with the Girgashite. Then you have unlawful idolatry. So these people start establishing rituals, like you see that a lot in the Catholic sect, where they started putting up all these statues in the churches and of saints and of Mary and all these demons that they have in the form of statues. And they say, oh, we have to do this. And when you need to pray for something, pray to the statue of Saint so-and-so. If you need something else, you pray to the saint of... So they start creating all these rituals and all these procedures. And then they force people. You are to bow to the idol. You are to bow to the idol. You know, that forcing people to submit to the idol. So the Jebusite combines with the Girgashite, and then you have anti-lawful idolatry. And then the Jebusite can also combine with the Canaanite, the pastor gone bad. And then that when they combine, then you get into potos, drinking. People start drinking spiritually. They get into addictions and bad Canaanite addictions, and they can't control themselves because they're trapped in that addiction by a Jebusite spirit that just compels them to continue in the Canaanite communion. It could also be, and I wonder if that's also related to women who get into bad relationships all the time, who always seem to pick the wrong guy for one reason or another. And I just laughed a little bit, but it's actually a very sad thing, you know, when women always, some women unfortunately always pick the wrong person. And I think that that's a little bit related to this potos thing. Because they get into bad Canaanite relationships. They allow themselves to be controlled by their emotions, their passions, and they fall for the wrong person every time, and they feel compelled to fall for the wrong person. Like a Jebusite spirit forcing them. You know, that's the guy that's the type of guy you're supposed to be with. And it always turns out to be an abuser or some lecherous kind of what's the word? Philanderer kind of person. So I think that's connected to this potos thing. Those who are Hittite, those who are prophetic, they go Hittite, and then the Hittite combines either with the bad pastor or the bad teacher. When it combines with the bad pastor, the Canaanite, then you have the Hittite-Canaanite combination, and that that would be the epithumia, the low passions that lead you into deception, that take you down the wrong paths. And when that Hittite combines with the bad teacher, it becomes Hittite Girgashite, and then it becomes Athelgeia, where you are incontinent, but you are incontinent only to the point of to the edge of where you're supposed to die for others. Then suddenly you become very continent and very self-contained. Oh no, I'm not going to take a risk like that. I'm not going to go out on a limb for someone else, then suddenly all that incontinence just suddenly gets contained. And then if you're an evangelist in that environment, because the male ministers are not being nurtured, right? Then your male evangelistic endowment becomes Amorite. And then the Amorite latches on to either the bad pastor or the bad teacher, because those are the two ministers that are in control of the place. So the Amorite latches on to the bad pastor, that's Amorite Canaanite, and that's when you get excess of wine, oinophligia. And the figure is, you know, of someone who's clubbing, who goes to the club to conquer women and have Canaanite relationships with them. And that's, so you're just using your conquest to feed your Canaanite passions. And that's oinophligia, excess of wine. And then the Amorite, when it combines with the bad teacher, the Girgashite, then you get Amorite Girgashite, and that is the Komos, which we saw was, it was translated as revelings in this verse. And that's when start writing the coattails of traditions to conquer, just like Billy Graham and others like him. So in short, these six things are how the male ministries get distorted in an environment controlled by the two female ministries, by the matriarchy of the soul, if that makes sense, of the female soul. And female, again, and I always say this, in case someone is listening to this recording and doesn't know what we've talked about ad nauseum all over the place, but female is, we're saying it spiritually. Most pastors, or practically all the pastors in the matriarchal church, in the church system right now, they're all spiritually female, even though the vast majority are men. But in God's eye, they're behaving like women. Like female souls instead of male spirits. And the other thing that that is interesting, I would dare say, with this list, and we briefly mentioned it before in the previous recording, is that in Greek, the list of the things that are said, you know, asangeia, epitumia, oinophligia, komos, potos, all of them are said in succession without an and in between, which is like what I usually see in a list. In Greek, I usually see a and the word and in Greek is kai, kai b, kai c, kai d, kai e, kai f, a and b and c and d and e and f. But in this list, for some reason, the first five are just mentioned in a row. Boom, 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 boom. Asangeia, epitumia, oinophligia, komos, potos. And then suddenly, a kai is inserted right before the last item. And so, kai, and then atemitos eidololatria, in other words, anti-law, idolatry. So I was asking the Lord, why is there that and right there? It's almost like it's separating the first five from the last one. And to be frank, I still have no understanding on that. Why is the last one separated from the other five? I don't know. But there must be an explanation for that. Maybe in some ways it's as if, it's almost as if in a certain sense, the last one is the culmination of the first five. It's like maybe there's some sort of process. Like the first five, you know, start manifesting, and then the sixth one is the culmination. When you reach that level, then you're really messed up. That's what I'm getting in my heart. I think that's what's going on there in the spirit. So when you reach God-defying laws of idolatry, that's when that solidifies that system. I hope that makes sense. I don't know, that's what I'm getting in my heart, that when you reach that level, the sixth item, that sixth item is the one that kind of cements the other five and allows them to stay, so that there's constant asalgeia, constant epithumia, constant oinophlegia, constant comos, constant potos. In other words, constant incontinence, constant low passions, constant wine bubbles, constant comos, which is reveling, and constant drinkings, potos. So those five other things start kind of flourishing and get solidified by number six. That's what I'm getting. And I could be wrong, but that's the sense I'm getting in my heart. And I feel confirmation to some extent of the spirit, as if, like, how shall we say it? If it's not fully correct, it is partially correct, at least. It's not that off. It's like it has an element of truth, what we just said, if it's not the whole truth, if you see what we were saying. Okay, so let's continue reading. So we read 1 Peter 4:3. I'll just read it one more time just to remember the list. For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles, the nations, when we walked in lasciviousness, lusts, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries. And I just felt of the Lord suddenly that a further confirmation that what we just said was right, because this is all in the context of what? The will of the Gentiles, the will of the nations. And the nations is Girgashite, as we shared on the website. And nations, unrighteous nations, are built around Girgashite traditions. Girgashite teachers passing down Girgashite traditions of men from one generation to the other. So it's Girgashite. And the word will, well, I guess the word will, you could say is evangelistic, because it's dilemma and it's connected to the heart. But, and maybe I'm fudging this a little bit too much, but when I saw the will of Gentiles, it just felt like, yeah, the Jebusite imposes the law, the will of the Amorite king through laws. And that's why I see the connection to what we were saying about abominable idolatry. It's as if to say that the Jebusite makes sure that the will of the nations gets fulfilled by establishing a system of idolatry and establishing laws that defy God's laws. There's a semantic quality to that last one. And we're thinking of it in, like, in general terms, but if you apply it to your own life, when you can have these issues. You can have asalgeia, you know, these menstrual issues, asalgeia. You could have epithumia. You could have oinophlegia, excess of wine. You could have comos, revelings. And you could have potos. You could have drinkings. But there's a moment when you decide consciously, I am going to do the opposite of God's will, and I'm going to make it God's laws. I'm going to make it a law of my own to do the opposite of God's laws. And then you start fashioning idols, and you start creating these idols, and something in your heart says, I'm going to worship this. And it's something tangible, and I'm going to focus on it and honor it with my life. And when you do that, then your other issues, menstrual issues, become cemented, like etched in stone in your flesh. So that's the thing. Just it's like God's saying, let's be careful, telling us to be careful. Not to, yeah, we may fall, may have issues, menstrual issues, spiritually speaking, but don't allow yourself to turn them into laws. Like, yeah, you can have an involuntary thing, but if you declare that involuntary thing a law and say, I will do that on purpose, then suddenly you've cemented that issue, if that makes sense. As opposed to say, oh, you know, I messed up, you know, you did something wrong and you feel bad about it. But the moment you go, no, I'm going to deliberately, like, even force myself to do it again. That's when you've reached a certain point. And also, when you start creating a priesthood to honor false idols, whatever that may be, it's like you start establishing a system of idolatry, and you say, we're going to honor this idol, whatever that may be, and I'm going to establish laws to follow that idol. I'm going to force myself to follow that idol, even if I see that this idol is just a piece of wood and it's not the real thing. I'm going to force myself to believe it's the real thing. And that's when you cement the other issues. I hope that makes sense. That's the sense that I'm getting in this verse. Yeah, when Peter was writing this, and all these words were coming to him, it's not like he just said, oh, let me just write a random list of bad things people do. Lasciviousness, what else? Lust. No, there was a pattern. God was saying something. There's a principle here. And I believe that's what God is saying. So I pray in the Spirit that as you and I meditate on these terms, that it will help us to identify issues, things where we are seeing combinations, like we have an apostolic side, how that apostolic side gets contaminated by the Kenite spirit or the Girgashite spirit, the bad pastor, bad teacher, and gets us to do things that are not right. Or if we are prophetic, then how the prophetic gets contaminated and it turns Hittite mixed with Kenite, Girgashite, and we get different things. So that's what this is for. And then also being careful not to fall into step number 6 when you start defining laws explicitly designed to oppose the laws of God in your heart. And when you start creating idols that you overtly worship and that you establish a priestly system in your heart for. For example, this is a silly example, but and I pray this is not misunderstood, because this is just an example and it may vary from person to person. But let's say that a person becomes obsessed with their physical appearance, in terms of like strength or muscles or whatever, and they just become obsessed, and they begin to idolize their own body, and then they say, "I'll go to the gym, 3 times a week, and I'm gonna do 2 hours every time," and they get into this obsession where they establish a priestly system where they go and honor their bodies as idols, 6 hours of gym stuff every week, and again, it's not that there's anything wrong with going to the gym or trying to have a healthy physical appearance or a healthy body. That's not what's wrong. But we're talking about where you just go deliberately and establish systems, procedures, and ways to worship your idol. And in this case, it's you, for example, establishing a procedure of going 3 times a week and doing 2 hours every time to do bodybuilding, or to do this to because you begin to worship your physical appearance. So that's the level we don't want to get to. Okay, because then it goes from involuntary to something very deliberate, and then it becomes those issues become cauterized, they get hardened and then you then it, they become very difficult to get rid of. So then 1 Peter 4:4 says, wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. And interestingly enough, the word strange is the word, when it says they think it strange, the word, the phrase they think it strange was translated from senizo. And when they Latinize it, they spell it X-E-N-I-Z-O. And as you can imagine, senit, that first part, X-E-N-I, sounds a lot like xenophobia, which is a fear of foreigners. So xeno means foreign. So in other words, they start seeing you as a foreigner because you're outside the system. See, this is all a system, the will of the nations. It's like a dome. Like you're living under the Thunderdome or something. You're living inside this system of oppression that is controlled by the pastors and the teachers, the two female ministries. And when you fall outside that system, you're a stranger to them. You're a foreigner. Like you're not one of us. You're not part of the body of Christ because you're led by the Spirit. And we are led by the soul. And then like Jacob and Esau, it's like a separation that starts forming. Like Isaac and Ishmael. Like two different breeds of people, even though they both call themselves Christians. So they think it's strange that ye run not with them, to the same excess of riot. And it's interesting, the word excess of riot, the phrase was translated from two words, excess from anakisis and riot asotia. But to be frank, I have no understanding on those words. They're different from the words we just saw in the previous verse. Let me just look at anakisis, which is excess, very quickly. It means an overflowing or a pouring out. An overflowing or pouring out. And riot is asotia, which comes from, it says an abandoned, dissolute life or profligacy, prodigality. And it comes from a, meaning without or negation, and sotso, which means to save or to be whole. Interesting. So it's doing the opposite of what saves you or keeps you safe. It's almost like total carelessness, like, you know, someone who drives like a madman and is not worried about, is out of control and not even worrying about his own safety or the safety of others. And I'm not sure how these two words fit in the context of the six things we just looked at. And by the way, in the list that we just saw, it's interesting that out of the six things, the only one that used two words in Greek was the last one, because all the others were one word, aselgeia, or epitumia, or oinofligia, or komos, or potos, and the last one was two, atemitos eidololatria. And I know that's not a coincidence. So it says, okay, so reading 1 Peter 4:4, wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. The phrase speaking evil of you is translated from the word, the verb blasphemeo, where we get the English word blasphemy, as you can imagine. And blasphemeo, the word blasphemy in Greek comes from two things, blapto, and that means to hurt, to harm, to injure. It's like it's used in Luke 4:35. It's only real appearance, blapto. It's also supposedly in Mark 16:18, but I don't believe in anything after verse 8 of Mark 16:8. I think everything after verse 8 of Mark 16 was added after Mark was written, the Gospel of Mark. So I don't believe, I don't even honor, I don't think of that as scripture, so I'm just going to pretend like I'm not seeing that, because that's not real in my eyes, in my understanding. So that God does not want us to pay attention to Mark 16, verses 9 through 20, I think it is. That was just appended at the end by people who wanted, who were uncomfortable with the very strange ending of Mark 16:8, of the Gospel of Mark. It just ends in a very abrupt way, and they said, no, we need to fix this. So they decided to add to God's word. So then Luke 4:35 is the only time that blapto really appears in scripture. It says, and Jesus rebuked him, saying, hold thy peace and come out of him. And when the devil had thrown him in the midst, he came out of him and hurt him not. So the demon did not hurt, I think, was it a child? I forget. The demon was possessing someone. The Lord Yeshua rebuked that spirit. It came out, and it didn't hurt the child. It didn't blopto the child. So it's to hurt, to harm. And the other part of blasphemy comes from feme, and that's where we get the word fame, if I'm not mistaken. Literally, that's what it means in Greek, fame or report. So it means, it has the connotation of reputation. It has to do with reputation. So blasphemy is literally in Greek, is the ruining of your reputation. And God takes that very seriously, as we have shared on the website, I believe, and in some audio snippets from some time ago. The last five commandments, number 6 through number 10, show the five rights of the individual. Like, for example, thou shalt not steal shows the right to property. Thou shalt not murder shows the right to life. Thou shalt not commit adultery shows the right to privacy. And you might say, how do you get privacy? But that's too long to explain. But the thing is that adultery is an intrusion into the privacy of the marriage of other people. It's like you're getting in the way between a husband and his wife. That's adultery, when you're trying to get in, wedge yourself in between something that is very private. That's why adultery is abominable. It's when people are trying to get in between a man and his wife, and that's a violation of privacy. So, and then the other commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness, exposes or reveals the right to a fair reputation. That's one of the five fundamental human rights. And unfortunately, in our legal system, we don't honor that right. We don't even know about that as a right. People might know about the right to life, the right to property, even though the U.S. Constitution does not protect that right. That doesn't even define it. But we kind of know that it's there, that the right is real, because we do have laws to protect, to some extent, the right to property. And we also are aware of the right to privacy, even though most people will not connect it to adultery, but it's the same. But it's, we do recognize the right to privacy. But I've never heard anyone talk about the human right of to have a fair reputation. And fair reputation means, you know, that if you are a good person, no one, it's against your human rights that someone is spreading rumors that you're a bad person. But if you are a bad person, and the other person is saying, spreading rumors that you're a bad person, they're not ruining your, you're not, they're not violating your right, because a fair reputation is the reputation you deserve. So that's a fundamental human right, and when people lie about you or say things about you that are not true and try to portray you as something you're not, they are in God's eyes committing blasphemy. They are injuring your fame or reputation, and that's abominable to God. So blasphemy literally is a violation of the right to a fair reputation. And I know we don't associate those two things, but that's exactly what it is, especially in the Greek. And that just shows you how holy the fair reputation of someone is in God's eyes, that when it's violated, God calls that blasphemy. Okay. So, going back to 1 Peter 4:4, so it says, speaking evil of you because they see you as a stranger, as a foreigner, you're foreign to the soul system, and therefore they will blaspheme against you. They will try to ruin your reputation. And God says they're blaspheming every time they speak ill of you. And they come under the judgment that corresponds to blasphemy. And they are breaking the ninth, I think it's the ninth commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. And then 1 Peter 4:5 says, we shall give account to him that is ready to judge the quick and the dead. And the word quick was translated from the living. I guess in Old English, quick meant living. That's why they use it a lot in the King James, but in the Greek, the word was zao. In zao, that's where we get the word zoe, which means life. So it's life, and more than biological life, it's spiritual life too. So it says, "Who shall give account to him that is ready to judge the living and the dead?" So in other words, these people who are blaspheming against you will have to give an account to God, who is ready to judge the living and the dead. So isn't it interesting? God says he judges the living. And if we take this spiritually, that means that those who are full of the life of God are also going to be judged. Judgments are unavoidable, whether you're good or bad. The difference is that if you're full of the life of God, when you're judged by him, the judgment will be the judgment will be like the verdict on your life, and the verdict is going to be a stamp of approval, and you're going to be blessed and recompensed, rewarded for eternity. But we're all judged. Judgments are unavoidable, whether the church wants that or not. The judgments of God are unavoidable. So he judges the living and the dead. And then verse 6 says something, and I think we kind of talked about this before. It says, for 1 Peter 4:6, for this cause was the gospel preached also to them that are dead, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, the sarks, but live according to God in the Spirit. And what we wanted to share this time, we already said it, but it's worth emphasizing that in this verse, the word that hits me real hard is also. And I'll read it again. For this cause was the gospel preached also to them that are dead, And you go, oh yeah, he's talking about those who were dead in their sins and they were born again. But why would he say also? And in the Greek, and I said to myself, the word is so, quote unquote, out of place. At least to our natural understanding, it's so out of place that I said to myself, maybe it wasn't in the original text. So what I did was I took the text, the verse in Greek, you know, from the Blue Letter Bible, I copied it, and then I pasted it in Google Translate. So I'll just read the first five words in Greek, if I'm reading them right. I'm not very good at reading Greek, but so I'll be butchering the pronunciation, I'm sure, but I'm going to read the first five or six words of the verse. It's eis toto gar kai nekrois eun evangelisti ina kritosi. And I'll stop reading. But so I said to myself, where is the also? Because I couldn't see it. And what I did was I started kind of deleting word by word from the Greek and seeing how what happened in Google Translate, how it would be translating it. So I went one by one, and I'm doing that right now. I'm repeating what I did a moment ago. So I'm still deleting some more. I'm deleting another word. And then I'm getting to the last the first five words, because I was deleting from the end, backwards towards the beginning of the verse. So all I have now are the first five words of the verse. Eis toto gar kai nekrois. Nekrois, I know, means dead. Because that's where we get necromancy, I've heard words in English that start with necro or something, and I know it has to do with dead people or something. So I know necrois means dead, and then gar, I have seen that word before, and when I've seen it, it seems to always mean because. So because or reason, you know, so I know gar kind of means something like because or reason, as I just said, because when you say because something, it's because you have a reason. And then toto, I think, means this. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to delete nekrois. And what I see right now on the right-hand side in Google Translate in English is for this reason too, T-O-O. So, and what I have in the Greek, the only thing left is eis toto gar kai. So I know toto means this. I know gar means because and can be translated as reason. So I know for this because or for this reason, and ace, the first word obviously means for. So for this reason, kai. Now the thing that puzzled me was kai. Every time I've seen it, it means and. A and B, B and C. You know, every time the word and would appear. When I went to look in the Greek, it was kai. So that's why it confused me. For this reason and dead? And that's when I realized, when I saw this translation in Google Translate, that kai in Greek can also mean also. So kai can mean and also, or to, or as well. So in Greek, it really says, for this reason too, for this reason also, to the dead, was the gospel preached. For this reason, so let's read, so now that we know that this word is the word also is in the original Greek, let's read it again. For this cause, or for this reason, was the gospel preached also to them that are dead. Okay, wait a second. So it's preached also to them that are dead. Well, we were all dead in sin, so why say also? And then when you start thinking about it, the only way for also to make sense means that that God is saying that this gospel is preached to the living and to the dead. And when you and then when you read the rest of the verse, when God mentions flesh, that they might be judged according to the men, as men in the flesh, then it's like God saying, I'm not just being spiritual here. I'm saying something that I want you to take a little more literally than you might be comfortable taking it. It's like God saying, I preach to those who are physically living, and I have also preached to those who are physically dead. Otherwise, the word also does not make sense. So that means that I preached, God is saying, I have sent the gospel to preach to the living in the flesh, and I have also sent the gospel to be preached to those who are dead in the flesh, who are no longer with us, who don't have flesh, who are dead. And this goes with what we were saying before about when the Lord Yeshua was resurrected and went to preach to the spirits in prison. And I think this is a confirmation, a very subtle confirmation from God, that in some circumstances, God preaches to those who have died. Because, and why? Because they've done something in their lives that have made them, and I say this with caution, not worthy, but for lack of a better term, it's like God decides, you've done something for me that I love, that will give you the privilege that I will preach to you after you die. And why after you die? Because while you're living, maybe you will not hear what I have to say, because there will be a fog of soulishness. Your soul will create a fog that will prevent my words getting to you. But once you're dead, because you'll be separated from the weakness of your flesh, then of your physical flesh, then the fog of your soul will dissipate and you will hear exactly what I have to say to you. And I'm going to give you one more chance after you're dead to receive some things that you could not receive while you were alive. And you say, and you might be uncomfortable with this, but that's what I see here. And I believe that's what God is saying in this verse and in the other verse, when God said that Yeshua preached to the spirits in prison, went down to preach to the spirits in prison. Why did he preach to people who are already dead? There's no chance for them to repent, supposedly. So why waste your time to go preach to the dead? Well, apparently, there's with some the opportunity to learn something and receive it after they're dead, and it will be counted to them as if they had received it in the flesh, like towards the end of their life, if that makes sense. But yeah, there is a penalty. Obviously, it's better if you believe it in the flesh, because while you're in the flesh, there's something you can do with what you receive. But once you're dead, it's like, yeah, you know, it's like kind of too late kind of thing. Yeah, but you will be converted, and then there's going to be the restoration of some of your eternal reward, because you believed after you were dead when God came and preached to you about that. If that makes sense. And even in some ways, if you believe after you're dead, it might have repercussions, like retroactive repercussions on things you did while you were alive, even though the impact of those things will not be as strong as if you had believed whilst you were alive, if that makes any sense. And that's what I'm getting from that verse. And I believe it's of the Lord. And I pray that you will see in the Spirit that that God will confirm it to you. And I pray that if this is of the Lord, that you will not receive it or reject it as blasphemy or some sort of heretical teaching, because this is coming from Scripture. We're not making this up. We're looking at the verses and God saying, I preach to the spirits in prison, and I also preach to the dead. And he's saying also, not just preach to the spiritually dead in a figurative, poetic sense. And he emphasizes that I'm being literal here by referring to flesh there, that they might be judged as men in the flesh. In other words, as if they were still living, physically living. Okay. But so that they may have life, it says here, but live according to God in the Spirit, so that in the Spirit they will receive a fruit of a reward of life for believing. It's like God saying, I don't want you to go into eternity without getting this. And God gives some people a last chance to receive it so that they can take that into eternity in the Spirit, and not lose it. And I feel like it's always because they did something in this realm that gave them that opportunity to be preached to after they're dead about something. And I believe it's with different people, it's different things that God will go preach to them. Things that they maybe were reluctant to believe whilst they were alive, and God will give them a chance to believe in that area. So I don't know if this is much more widespread than I can even imagine. Maybe it's not just one person here and there, that maybe it's much more common in a sense, but the preaching will be about a specific area if they did something on earth that kind of gave them that second chance. God granted them that second chance because of something they did. So I think that's all that we were supposed to say. We more or less finished going through the appearances of flesh in 1 Peter 4. It was 3 verses, so it took us a while to go through all 6 verses, but I pray in the Lord that this helped to kind of get an understanding of the 6 types of issues of menstrual issues that can flow out of us because of a matriarchal influence, a soul influence on our lives, the pastoral teacher influence, and how it can produce 2 different types of distortions of our apostolic endowments or our prophetic endowments or our evangelistic endowments. And we pray that this thing that we just said about the preaching to the dead will make sense to you in the Spirit as God confirms it to you. And we also pray that you saw what we just said about what God is saying about blasphemy and ruining the fair reputation of others. That God sees that violation of that right is tantamount to blasphemy in God's eyes. And that when the matriarchal believer starts saying all these horrible things about a remnant believer, what God hears is blasphemy, blasphemy, blasphemy. And then judgment comes on that person in the form of punishment against blasphemy. Because it's as if God sees that as an affront to him, as if you are insulting his reputation. Because that person starts saying that such and such and such and such thing is diabolical, is satanic. And turns out that such and such thing that they're calling diabolical and satanic is coming from God himself, speaking through that remnant person. So in defiling, in demonizing that remnant believer, they're demonizing and blaspheming against God himself. But they don't realize that. Okay, so Lord willing, we will continue with the appearances of Sarks in 2 Peter in the next audio recording. Thank you very much for listening, and may the Lord bless you through these meditations on Sarks. Amen.